grace. Grace.
Grace.
Grace.
All right, this week in Through the Bible, we are picking up where we were last week in Ezra. We're starting in chapter 5 of Ezra. We began last week in our walk through Ezra with the initial decree from Cyrus to rebuild and restore the temple in Jerusalem. Now, you remember, of course, as I keep on reminding you, that when Gabriel spoke to Daniel, he talked about the fact that there was going to be a command from the issuing of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That would be the date from that day forward. They're going to count towards X number of days until Messiah came. Though it wasn't specifically said in those terms, but that's the way it worked out. Now, we went back through, forward from Daniel through the rest of the Old Testament, looking for, the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And we found four commands altogether to return to Jerusalem and do reconstruction work, but the first three were all focused upon the temple. The last one was focused on the actual city of Jerusalem, and that involved Nehemiah. So the timeline for all this was, which includes Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah, King Cyrus from 550 to 530 BC gave the first decree, and it's recorded in Ezra chapter 1, which can be a little bit confusing because Ezra covers the scope of all of it, though it's not limited to just Ezra. Then King Darius in 517 BC gave the second decree, and that's recorded in Ezra chapter 6. Then King Xerxes, the father of Artaxerxes in 485 through 465 BC, that is the whole life story of Esther, and it's recorded, of course, in the book of Esther that bears her name. Then his son, King Artaxerxes, in 458 BC, gave the third decree that involved, and that is the one that involved Ezra himself, and is recorded in Ezra chapter 7. So the first six chapters in Ezra don't even have Ezra in it. It's recording events before Ezra showed up. So the third decree was to go back, was given by King Artaxerxes the first, to go back and restore and rebuild the temple. But the last one was also King Artaxerxes the first, son of King Xerxes, who was alive during Esther's time, who Esther was married to. King Artaxerxes the first in 445 BC gave the fourth decree, and that involved Nehemiah. And you see that in Nehemiah chapter 2. And that was to rebuild the city and particularly the wall. So that's the outline of what was going on. Now, you'll see that in chapters 5 and 6, we revisit this old decree as it's looked up in the archives by the current King Darius due to some busybodies in Jerusalem who were hoping to stop the construction. The only thing worse than a busybody is a busybody with authority. But God's favor, thank God, is more powerful than the schemes of busybodies. So, now before we get started, I want to tell you that I'm no great historian, but, and I don't have an axe to grind or a case to make, but all my studies up to this point had led me to the conclusions that I've set forth as true regarding which king was which as these events have unraveled before us. That having been said, I've come to believe that it was more than possible that the Artaxerxes under whom Nehemiah served is the same Artaxerxes who commanded Ezra to go to Jerusalem, as I just mentioned. Now, this is not impossible, as the dates are well within one person's lifetime. Up to now, I have agreed with other people that Ezra was under Artaxerxes II, making him later. And the reason for this is not without reason, because when Ezra arrives in Jerusalem, the wall was already built, which was during the time of Nehemiah. However, it is possible that Ezra had arrived first, then left to return back to Babylon for a decent period of time, as seems to be indicated in these chapters we're going to look at tonight, and having received an edict from Artaxerxes I to return again, he did so with a good number of Jews with him. And this may be when he came to the Jerusalem that already had a wall already erected, already constructed. I need a little bit more time to study and collaborate the narratives to be absolutely certain, but I'm pretty certain that's where it is now, including the dates that I gave you just a little while earlier. Now, in the end, of course, it really has no meaningful impact on the events. But, you know, I like to keep things neat and tidy in terms of chronology as possible, so this probably bothers me more than it does you. All that having been said, let's continue in Ezra chapter 5, where these busybodies with authority try to thwart the progress of the reconstruction, because these guys who have authority were given authority underneath another person's kingship, under another man's jurisdiction. And so they sent word back to King Darius saying, hey, these guys are building their temple and reconstructing Jerusalem without permission for the king. And so King Darius looked it up in their archives and come to find out the people that were busybodies who had authority from Babylon to be there and patrol the Trans-Euphrates, they were just stirring up trouble because, in fact, they had received the go-ahead of the king to do what they were doing. So that's what this was all about. So in Ezra chapter 5, starting verse 1, says, then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, son of Iddo, prophesied concerning the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Josadak, began to rebuild the temple of God in Jerusalem. The prophets of God were with them, supporting them. At that time, Tatnia, governor of the Trans-Euphrates, Shethar, Bozneah, and their colleagues came to them and asked, who gave you the authority to rebuild this temple and to complete this structure? They also asked them, what are the names of the men who were building this edifice? Verse 5, but God was watching over the elders of Judah, and they were not stopped until a report could be dispatched to Darius, and a letter could be sent back concerning this. This is a copy of the letter that Tatnia, governor of the Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar Bozenai, and his colleagues, who were the officials of the Trans-Euphrates, sent back to King Darius. The report they sent to him was written as follows. To King Darius, all greetings. Let it be known to the king that we have gone to the province of Judah, to the temple of the great God. It has been, and I want you to notice how even people who were pagan back then referred to the God of Israel as the great God. I find that very significant. It says, it is being built with large stones and timbers and being placed in the walls. The timbers are being placed in the walls. This work is being done with all diligence and is prospering in their hands. When inquired of the elders, asking them, who gave you the authority to rebuild this temple and to complete this structure? We also inquired of the names in order to inform you so that we might write you the names of the men who were their leaders. They responded to us in the following way. We are servants of the God of heaven and earth. We are rebuilding the temple, which was previously built many years ago. And they're right. This is talking about, this was a temple that was created by Solomon or developed by Solomon after the death of his father. And it continued all these years and they were rebuilding it. It says, a great king of Israel built it and completed it. But after our ancestors angered the God of heaven, he delivered them into the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, the Chaldean who destroyed this temple and exiled the people to Babylon. But in the first year of King Cyrus of Babylon, King Cyrus enacted a decree to rebuild this temple of God. Even the gold and silver vessels in the temple of God that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem and had brought to the palace in Babylon, even those things King Cyrus brought from the palace of Babylon and presented them to a man by the name of Sheshbazzar, whom he appointed as governor. He said to him, take these vessels and go deposit them in the temple in Jerusalem and let the house of God be rebuilt in its proper location. Then this Sheshbazzar went and laid the foundations of the temple of the God of Jerusalem. From that time to the present moment, it has been in the process of being rebuilt, although it is not yet finished. Now, if the king is so inclined, let a search be conducted in the royal archives in Babylon in order to determine whether King Cyrus did in fact issue orders for this temple of God to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. Then let the king send us a decision concerning this matter. So, that's what was said. Now, the second decree was made by Darius himself, who also was part of the Persian Empire. He commanded the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem in 517 BC, which is recorded here in Ezra chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. This is only 21 years after Cyrus the Great had issued the initial first command. So in Ezra chapter 6, starting verse 1, it says, "So Darius the king issued orders, and they searched the archives of the treasury, which were deposited there in Babylon. A scroll was found in the citadel of Ecbatana, very hard to say, which is in the province of Media, and it was inscribed as follows: Memorandum. In the first year of his reign, King Cyrus gave orders concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place where sacrifices are offered. Let its foundations be set in place, its height to be 90 feet and its width at 90 feet, with three layers of large stones and one layer of timber. The expense is to be subsidized by the royal treasury." So Babylon, ironically, was the one that was footing the bill for this. Verse 5, "Therefore, let the gold and the silver vessels of the temple of God, which Nebuchadnezzar brought from the temple in Jerusalem and carried to Babylon, be returned and brought to their proper place in the temple in Jerusalem. Let them be deposited in the temple of God." Now, Tattaniah, governor of the Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai, and their colleagues, the officials of the Trans-Euphrates, "All of you stay far away from there." So they got theirs. The busybodies were told, stay away. That's none of your business. Stay away from it. Verse 7, "Let the work of this temple of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews rebuild this temple of God in its proper place. I also hereby issue orders as to what you are to do with those elders of the Jews in order to rebuild this temple of God." So these guys that started the trouble and tried to get the Jews in trouble from the Trans-Euphrates, they are now are going to be in a position of, they have to stay far away, but they're also in the position of having to aid them and help them. So this was adding insult to injury. So in verse 8, it says, "I also hereby issue orders as to what you are to do with these elders of the Jews in order to rebuild this temple of God. From the royal treasury, from the taxes of the Trans-Euphrates, the complete costs are to be given to these men so that there may be no interruption in the work. Whatever is needed, whether oxen or ram or lambs for burnt offerings for the God of heaven, or wheat or salt or wine or oil as required by the priests who are in Jerusalem, must be given to them daily without any neglect, so that they may be offering incense to the God of heaven and may be praying for the good fortune of the king and his family." So I want you to see this. Not only did God turn the tables on these busybodies, and now they are pretty much kind of full-time, because it's a daily thing, having to see to it that these provisions are given to Israel regularly for the rebuilding, not only the rebuilding of the temple, but also the offering of the sacrifices. But I also want you to notice this other thing, this little interesting fact about Darius, is that whether he knew beforehand or whether he just made himself aware of it since then, because he was a good leader, he knew what things were necessary for priests, Israelite priests, to offer. He knew it wasn't, you know, because a lot of other religions offered pigs and other type of animals, but he knew for a fact that it required oxen and rams and lambs for burnt offerings. He also knew that wheat and salt and oil and wine were used by the priests in Jerusalem as well. And so he specifically called out those things as being necessary to be brought to them daily without any neglect. So that, and I want you to notice the last thing here, he wanted them not only to be offering these incense to God of heaven, but to also be praying for the good fortune of himself and his family. He wanted these priests in Jerusalem to be praying for him and praying for his family. This is a pagan king in King Darius of Persia, and he is asking these Jewish priests to be praying to the God of heaven for the good fortune of himself and his family. He obviously believed in the power of what they were calling the great God of heaven. So very, very important things. Again, things that secular history will not bring up that are very clearly outlined here in Scripture. So pick up now in verse 11 in Ezra chapter 6 says, "I hereby give orders that if anyone changes this directive, A beam is to be pulled up from his house, and he is to be raised up and impaled on it, and his house is to be reduced to rubbish, to a rubbish heap, for this desecration. May God, who makes his name to reside there, overthrow any king or nation who reaches out to cause such change so as to destroy this temple of God in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have given orders. Let them be carried out with precision. So here, I mean, it seems pretty clear that Darius is recognizing the God of Israel, or, you know, the true God, as exactly that, the true God. And he even appeals to God. He says, may God, who makes his name to reside there, overthrow any king or nation who reaches out to cause such change so as to destroy this temple of God in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have given orders. Let them be carried out with precision. So this is really quite amazing stuff. Now going on to verse 13, it says, then Tatnai, governor of the Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai and their colleagues acted accordingly with precision, just as Darius the king had given instructions. Verse 14, the elders of the Jews continued building and prospering, while at the same time Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo continued prophesying. They built and brought it to completion by the command of the God of Israel and by the command of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, kings of Persia. So you see, they even bring these kings up in order, but I want you to notice also they skip King Xerxes. That was during the life of Ezra, and a lot was going on there, and I believe that probably the temple and construction in that time period probably stopped progressing, at least for a while, though, due to the efforts of Mordecai and Esther toward the latter end of Xerxes' reign, they enjoyed great favor and prosperity from the king. But it looks like it was picked up in earnest by his son, King Artaxerxes I, king of Persia. Verse 15, they finished this temple on the third day of the month of Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. So the temple itself was finished, but there was, of course, a lot more work to be done on the city. And, of course, the wall that surrounds the city had not even been touched yet. That was a Nehemiah thing. Now, verse 16, the people of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the rest of the exiles observed the dedication of this temple of God with joy. For the dedication of this temple of God, they offered 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and 12 male goats for the sin of all Israel, according to the number of the tribes of Israel. And guess who it was again who had to supply all this to them? The governor and the officials of the Trans-Euphrates, the busybodies who tried to stop the work. Verse 18, they appointed the priests by their divisions and the Levites by their divisions over the worship of God at Jerusalem in accordance with the book of Moses, which, of course, we refer to that book as probably the book of, it was probably referring to the collection of writings of Moses, which included everything from Genesis on through Numbers, but it more than likely was talking about Exodus and Leviticus, more than likely. Now, it says, through Deuteronomy, but Moses was Genesis through Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy being the book that was a completion work of Moses before he died to the second generation of Israelites who had been born in the wilderness or been brought out into the wilderness at 20 years age or younger, so that they might know these things that their parents knew but did not honor and believe. So that's the book of Deuteronomy. But that was written by Moses by inspiration. The other books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, were written not by inspiration, but by dictation. And there's a huge, huge, colossal difference between the two. But we're not going to get into that tonight. We've touched on that many times in the past, so you kind of have a bag to put that in already. But so in verse 20, it says, the priests and Levites had purified themselves, every last one, and they all were ceremonially pure. They sacrificed the Passover lamb for all the exiles, for their colleagues, the priests, and for themselves. The Israelites who were returning from the exile ate it, along with all those who had joined them in separating themselves from the uncleanness of the nations of the land to seek the Lord God of Israel. They observed the feast of unleavened bread for 7 days with joy, for the Lord had given them joy and had changed the opinion of the king of Assyria toward them, so that he assisted them in the work on the temple of God, the God of Israel. Now, as we go into chapter 7, the third time a formal decree went out regarding the Jews and their home in Jerusalem was in 458 BC by the, not the next king, but the king after that, and that's Artaxerxes I, who also was part of the Persian Empire, and is, as is recorded in Ezra chapter 7, where we're about to read in verse 1, and in verses 10 through 28. This decree was 59 years after the one reissued by Darius, which we just read in chapter 6. So, here we are in chapter 7 in Ezra, starting in verse 1. It says, "Now after these things had happened during the reign of King Artaxerxes of Persia, Ezra came up from Babylon. Ezra was the son of Seraiah, who was the son of Azariah, who was the son of Hilkiah, who was the son of Shalom, who was the son of Zadok, who was the son of Ahitub, who was the son of Amariah, who was the son of Azariah, who was the son of Mariath, who was the son of Zeriah, who was the son of Uzai, who was the son of Bukai, who was the son of Abishua, who was the son of Phinehas, who was the son of Eleazar, who was the son of Aaron, the chief priest." So, in traditional fashion, they're showing the direct lineage between Ezra and the chief priest Aaron, who was the high priest. So he was of a lineage of the priests, which is why he was involved in the temple and its construction. But there was a direct bloodline there. Verse 6, it says, "This Ezra is the one who came up from Babylon. He was a scribe who was skilled in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. The king supplied him with everything he requested, for the hand of the Lord his God was on him. In the 7th year," and again, I want you to see the sovereignty of God there. It says, "The king supplied him with everything he requested because the hand of the Lord his God was on him." That's why the king did what he did. The king did what he did because the Father God directed the heart of this king, steered the heart of the king, like the Bible says that he can steer the heart of kings like rivulets of water. He can steer the heart of kings, and that's exactly what he was doing here. So in verse 7, and that's not completely to the ignoring of the man, because God was for the salvation of all these people, whether pagan or not. We know that from the New Testament. The Bible says very clearly, it's not God's desire that any man perish, but that all come to the knowledge of the truth. We know that it, way back when all this started with Pharaoh coming out of Egypt, that God wanted, he said, "For this very purpose I raised you up, that I might make my power known and might make my name famous." And it really didn't make any difference what the Pharaoh did. If he told the people they can't go, or if he told them that they could go, either way, that would have been the result. God's name would have been made famous, and his power would have been known. But because he rejected it, it wound up not working for the king of Pharaoh. He wound up dying. And his firstborn died. And he died not knowing God. What a horrible, horrible plight. But that wasn't God's desire. God's desire was for the Pharaoh to have a soft heart and respond. But if you remember back when we were going through that in the book of Exodus, we found that Pharaoh hardened his heart X number of times. And after this last time, it says then God agreed with him, and in his sovereignty, he hardened Pharaoh's heart. But it began, it was not just a unilateral act of God where he just decided, "Well, I don't like Pharaoh, so we'll just kill him." It was in accordance with decisions that Pharaoh made. Pharaoh was hardening his own heart. Every time God said something, he rejected him, and he dug his heels in, and he resisted him. And finally, God said, "Okay, if you decide that you're going to resist me, I agree with your decision, and I sovereignly harden your heart." But that was not God's original intent. He wanted to save him. And so was the same true with Cyrus and with Nebuchadnezzar. It was true with Darius, with Xerxes, and here with King Artaxerxes. So in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes, Ezra brought up from Jerusalem some of the Israelites and some of the priests and Levites and attendants and gatekeepers and the temple servants. And again, I want you to notice that Babylon was actually north of them. And yet, here it is. It says they're going up to Jerusalem. This is always the way it works in Scripture. Regardless of where you're coming from on the compass, on the planet, you are always going up to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is considered the center of the earth. It is literally not the highest place on earth, obviously. That's not what it means. Up to just is a term of honor. It means that we're going from a low place to a high place, spiritually speaking. Okay. So in the seventh year, King Artaxerxes, Ezra brought up to Jerusalem, up to Jerusalem, some of the Israelites and some of the priests, the Levites, the attendants, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants. He entered Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. On the first day of the first month, he had determined to make the ascent from Babylon, and on the first day of the fifth month, he arrived in Jerusalem, for the good hand of his God was on him. Now Ezra had dedicated himself to the study of the law of God, to its observance, and to teaching its statutes and judgments in Israel. What follows is a copy of the letter that the king Artaxerxes gave to Ezra, the priestly scribe. Ezra was a scribe in matters pertaining to the commandments of the Lord and his statutes over Israel. Quote, Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven. I have now issued a decree that anyone in my kingdom from the people of Israel, even the priests and Levites who wish to do so, may go up with you to Jerusalem. You are authorized by the king and his seven advisors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your possession, and to bring silver and gold, which the king and his advisors have freely contributed to the God of Israel, who resides in Jerusalem, along with all the silver and gold that you may collect throughout all the province of Babylon, and the contributions of the people and the priests for the temple of their God, which is in Jerusalem. Now, this isn't the end of the quote, but I want to point something out to you. He says that he had issued this decree that anyone in my kingdom from the people of Israel and so on who wishes to do so may go up with you to Jerusalem. Now, this isn't important now, but it will be when we later go through the book of Ezekiel. You'll find that there was a vision given to Ezekiel of a temple that was never built. And in practical terms, it would have been very hard to build it anyway. The construction of it was ridiculously huge. But the condition upon which Ezekiel was to reveal the plans of this new temple to Israel was if the people repented at large. Now, you need to know that Ezekiel was alive during the time period of these events right here. He was in Babylon in captivity. So God is, you've got Jeremiah, who was in Jerusalem before its destruction and shortly thereafter, who was during the reign of King, the king of Israel, or the king of Judah at the time, which I'm drawing a blank, Zedekiah. And he remained there, even though the king of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, deported everybody. He did not deport, there's a handful of people he did not deport, including Jeremiah. Jeremiah eventually wound up being carried off captive into Egypt, along with other Jews. But so Jeremiah was alive during these time periods, plural. At a slightly later date, Esther, of course, was alive. You had, at the same time, Ezekiel was alive, and Ezra was alive, and Nehemiah was alive. All these people, and of course you have some of the prophets we read earlier, were also alive during the same time. So, I mean, you read the different books, but sometimes you don't realize many of these people were alive at the same time period, and God was using each one of them in an orchestra to do his bidding and to get certain things accomplished. And I think that that's important to know, but I digress by saying that. What I want you to notice in this verse 13, that he gave a command that to anyone in his kingdom from the people of Israel, even the priests and Levites who wish to do so, may go up with you to Jerusalem. And what they got as a response was a very pitiful response. A very small portion of Jews actually went up to Jerusalem. Most of them were comfortable in their captivity. And that says something. They were not passionate for the things of God. When given an opportunity to return back to Jerusalem and help rebuild it and help rebuild the temple and to go back into their true worship of God, they chose to stay behind in Babylon. And that is the reason why later on, when we get to the book of Ezekiel, You'll remember, you'll see when we get there, how the vision was given to him of this temple, but it was only to be revealed to plans, were only to be revealed to the people when their hearts were repentant, which is why it was not revealed to them. Because when these people were coming back, this was a time period for Ezekiel, and the people's heart were not repentant. And so, therefore, the plans were not revealed to them. So anyway, that's just a little bit of a preamble of what we will see when we go to Ezekiel. But this verse has a bearing on that because of the fact that you can see they give a very cavalier response, a very nonchalant response to being free to go back and rebuild the temple and worship the God of heaven. So the people were at large not repentant. So going on with verse 14, it says, "You are authorized by the king and his seven advisors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of your God, which is in your possession, and to bring silver and gold, which the king and his advisors have freely contributed to the God of Israel, who resides in Jerusalem, along with all the silver and gold that you may collect throughout the province of Babylon, and the contributions of the people and the priests for the temple of their God, which is in Jerusalem." Verse 17. With this money, you should be sure to purchase bulls, rams, lambs, along with the appropriate meal offerings and libations. You should bring them to the altar of the temple of your God, which is in Jerusalem. You may do whatever seems appropriate to you and your colleagues with the rest of the silver and the gold in keeping with the will of your God. Deliver to the God of Jerusalem the vessels that are given to you for the service of the temple of your God, the rest of the needs for the temple of your God that you may have to supply, you may do so from the royal treasury. I, King Artaxerxes, hereby issue orders to all the treasurers of the Trans-Euphrates that you precisely execute all that Ezra, the priestly scribe of the law of God of heaven, may request of you, up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of olive oil, and unlimited salt. Everything that the God of heaven has required should be precisely done for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should there be wrath against the empire of the king and against his son? So again, you've got another king in Persia who recognizes a god separate from their Persian god. And they're honoring the God of Israel, the God of heaven, and saying, you know what, we want these things done, because if you don't do this, the God of heaven, the God of the Israelites, wrath will be kindled against our kingdom and against our children. Why would we want to do that? That's what he's saying here. I'll read that again, verse 23. Everything that the God of heaven has required should be precisely done for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should there be wrath against the empire of the king and his sons? So, going on with verse 24, it says, "Furthermore, be aware that the fact that you have no authority to impose tax, tribute, or toll on any of the priests and Levites, the musicians, the doorkeepers, the temple servants, or the attendants at the temple of this God. Now, you, Ezra, in keeping with the wisdom of your God, which you possess, appoint judges and court officials who can arbitrate cases on behalf of all the people who are in the Trans-Euphrates and who know the laws of your God. Those who do not know this law should be taught it." So, I mean, this king is going above and beyond the ordinary. This king, Artaxerxes, is not only saying that you guys should govern yourself in Jerusalem by your own laws and the laws of your God, but I want the whole Trans-Euphrates to be governed by these laws, and you set up people who know it, and if they don't know it, teach it to them, right? So in verse 26, everyone who does not observe both the law of your God and the law of the king will be completely liable to the appropriate penalty, whether it is death or banishment or confiscation of property or detainment in prison. Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, who so moved in the heart of the king, to so honor the temple of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. He has also conferred his favor on me before the king, his advisors, and all the influential leaders of the king. I gained strength as the hand of the Lord my God was on me, and I gathered leaders from Israel to go up with me. I love this about some of these people, these Old Testament patriarchs, how they did not build themselves up, they built God up. And they recognized that even though they had influence, and even though they had power, and even though they had been given wisdom, they attributed it all to God. They did not, just like Paul, they refused to boast in these accomplishments, because they knew these accomplishments were not truly accomplished by them. It was given to them by God. And that is a huge thing. It's very, very important, especially for leaders, that they be humble. It's important for anyone, but especially for someone who is leading, because that's an example to follow. Now, picking up now in Ezra chapter 8, starting verse 1, and oh goody, I get to read a lot of names again. Starting in verse 1, it says, "These are the leaders of those enrolled with them by genealogies who were coming up with me from Babylon during the reign of King Artaxerxes. From the descendants of Phinehas, Gershom. From the descendants of Ithamar, Daniel. From the descendants of David, Hattush. From the son of Shechaniah. From the descendants of Parosh, Zechariah. And with him were enrolled by genealogy 150 men. From the descendants of Pahath, Moab, Elihanai, son of Zerahiah, and with him 200 men. From the descendants of Zatu, Shechaniah, son of Jaziel, with him 300 men. From the descendants of Adin, Abed, son of Jonathan, and with him 50 men. From the descendants of Elam, Jeshiah, son of Athaliah, and with him 70 men. From the descendants of Shephatiah, Zebadiah, son of Michael, and with him 80 men. From the descendants of Joab, Obadiah, son of Jehiel, and with him 218 men. From the descendants of Bani, this guy we've seen many times, Shelemith, son of Joshaphat, and with him 160 men. From the descendants of Bebai, Zechariah, son of Bebai, and with him 28 men. From the descendants of Azgad, Jehanan, son of Hakatan, and with him 110 men. From the descendants of Adonikam, there were the latter ones. Their names were Eliphelet, Jeuel, and Shemaiah, and with him 60 men. From the descendants of Bigviah, Uthai, and Zakur, and with them 70 men. I had them assemble at the canal that flows towards Ahava, and we camped there for 3 days. I observed that the people and the priests were present, but I found no Levites there. So I sent for Eleazar, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jerib, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshulam, who were leaders, and Joreb, and Elnathan, who were teachers. I sent them to Iddo, who was the leader in the place called Casaphia. I told them what to say to Iddo and his relatives, who were the temple servants in Casaphia, so that they would bring us attendance for the temple of our God. Due to the fact that the good hand of our God was on us, they brought us a skilled man from the descendants of Mila, son of Levi, son of Israel. This man was Sherebiah, who was accompanied by his son and brothers, 18 men, and Heshabiah, along with Jeshiah, from the descendants of Merari, with his brothers and their sons, 20 men, and some of the temple servants that David and his officials had established for the work of the Levites, 220 of them. They were all designated by name. I called for a fast there by the Havilah Canal, so that we might humble ourselves before our God and seek from him a safe journey for us, our children, and all of our property." Now, and again, this is a great example. They were already told by God to go, so they already knew that they were going to prosper. They were given the protection and the funding and the command of the king with his signet ring, also providing protection and provision. But I want you to notice how they humbled themselves even still and asked for something that they knew they already were given. They're asking for it. There's humility here, and I love that about them. It's a great life lesson to hold on to, because there's a lot of things in the New Testament it tells us to pray about that are also already promised. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't ask. You should never be presumptuous with God. So I think this is a beautiful example. Verse 22 says, I was embarrassed to request soldiers and horsemen from the king to protect us from the enemy along the way, because we had said to the king, the good hand of our God is on everyone who is seeking him, but his great anger is against everyone who forsakes him. So we fasted and prayed to our God about this, and he answered us. So again, I love this. The king had already made a proclamation of protection, but Ezra did not want to ask for an entourage from the king, a military force to go with them with horsemen and soldiers to protect them, because he'd already made a proclamation of God's power and that God's hand was on them and protecting them. And so he didn't want to go back on that and say, but we still probably need some protection from you too. He wanted to show the strength and the power of his God, but he wanted to do it without presumption. And again, that's, I think, very, very important. Verse 24, then I set apart 12 of the leading priests together with Sherebiah and Hashabiah and 10 of their brothers. And I weighed out for them the silver, the gold, and the vessels intended for the temple of our God, items that the king, his advisors, his officials, and all Israel who were present had contributed. I weighed out to them 650 talents of silver, silver vessels worth 100 talents, 100 talents of gold, 20 gold bows worth 1,000 derricks, and 2 exquisite vessels of gleaming bronze as valuable as gold. Then I said to them, you are holy to the Lord, just as these vessels are holy. The silver and the gold are a voluntary offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Be careful with them and protect them until you weigh them out before the leading priests and the Levites and the family leaders of Israel in Jerusalem in the storeroom of the temple of the Lord. So again, you see a practical thing. There's accountability. Not only is he giving it to them, but he made he wrote down what was given to the people. But then he entrusted them with it. And then when they showed it to the temple, they had a ledger to prove who had what. So it was being counted out to those people when they arrived in Jerusalem, it could be seen that they actually were delivering them the fullness of what was given into their hands to protect. So there's accountability, another huge church principle. Verse 28 says, then I said to them, you are holy to the Lord, just as these vessels are holy. The silver and the gold are a voluntary offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Be careful with them and protect them. Until you weigh them out before the leading priests and the Levites and the family leaders of Israel and Jerusalem in the storerooms of the temple of the Lord. Then the priests and Levites took charge of the silver, the gold, and the vessels that had been weighed out and transported them to Jerusalem to the temple of our God. On the 12th day of the first month, we began traveling from Avala Canal to Jerusalem, or to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he delivered us from our enemies and from bandits along the way. So we came to Jerusalem. I love that. But, it's kind of like what John, in the Gospel of John wrote, because clearly there's stories right there. I mean, right there, verse 31, there are stories to be told, but he doesn't tell them. It says, the hand of their God, of God was upon them as he delivered us from our enemies and from bandits along the way. So clearly they had times when people had come against them and tried to attack them, but God protected them. And I'd love to know those stories, but we're not given them. In the same way that the Gospel of John says, if all the works and miracles that Jesus did and his teachings were to be written down, I don't suppose the world itself could contain the volumes that were written, but that would be written. But nevertheless, the ones that are written that you might believe. So there's much to be told, but evidently the things we learn about are things that are most important. So God's not holding back on us, but nonetheless, I just think it's kind of interesting that there's still stories to be told. So in verse 32, it says, so we came to Jerusalem, and we stayed there for 3 days. On the fourth day, we weighed out the silver, the gold, and the vessels in the hand of the house of our God into the care of Meremoth, son of Uriah, the priest, and Eleazar, son of Phinehas, who were accompanied by Jozabad, son of Jeshua, and Noadah, son of Benui, who were Levites. Everything was verified by number and by weight, and the total weight was written down at that time. The exiles who were returning from the captivity offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all of Israel, 96 rams, 77 male lambs, along with 12 male goats as a sin offering, all of this was a burnt offering to the Lord, which means, you know, that means that the entire sacrifice was burnt. They didn't separate the shoulder, the entrails, anything like they did with other sacrifices. This was a whole burnt offering. And, you know, the whole burnt offerings were sometimes offered for sin, but were always offered as a indicator of the people of God being fully dedicated to him. We belong 100% to you. The last verse is verse 36. It says, then they presented the decrees of the king to the king's satraps and the governors of the Trans-Euphrates, who gave help to the people and to the temple of God. And there you have it. So that's all there is to these chapters. I hope that it's helping to build a case for you so you can see how this whole thing unraveled. But and there's various tendrils to this that are important, because even though these events are important in and of their own self, they are also fulfilling prophecy or words that were given to Daniel by Gabriel, that at the end of the construction of Jerusalem, not the temple, like we're dealing right here with Ezra, but when Nehemiah comes along and finishes the wall and the city, from the day that he's issued the command to go back and restore and rebuild the wall, Nehemiah's given that command, that issuing of the command, from that day, they were given X number of days to count until Messiah came. And so very, very important stuff. And remember, when Messiah came, he's going to be recognized as a prince. And if you count those days, they go right to the very day of the triumphant entry of Jesus into Jerusalem before the beginning of the week that he was crucified. So God's brilliant. He knows what he's doing. And all we're doing is just, like Albert Einstein said one time, he said, I'm just thinking God's thoughts after him. Of course, Albert Einstein was not born again. He rejected that notion. But the bottom line is that he was not ascribing to these thoughts for himself any more than we are. We're just thinking God's thoughts after him and being edified for it. So,
great. Grace. Grace. Grace.